My name is Michael Ennells, and I live in Acacia Drive, Malden, where I've lived basically all my life. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about the development of Acacia Drive and something that happened during the war. Acacia Drive originally ran from the Queen Victoria and Spittle Road for about 100 yards as a muddy track where some people on the right-hand side, as you go down, had developed about half a dozen houses. And then it came to a stop, and there was a field owned by Mr. Wallace Binder. Now, in about 1938, Mr. Binder decided to develop this field to allow an extension of Acacia Drive, and he put in a proper concrete road with all the services, etc. And my parents and a neighbour decided to build a house on the left-hand side. We were the first house there. And my parents got married in 1939 and moved in on Christmas Eve. I was born in the house in 1942. And then in 1944, on the 20th September, Mr. Hitler very kindly destroyed this semi-detached pair with a direct hit with a doodlebug. Now, a doodlebug is one of the V1 flying bombs, and they are extremely powerful. And that night, this happened at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and there were three coming low. Normally with doodlebugs, the engines cut out and they dive down. These, the engines were still going, and one hit the corner of our next door neighbour's house. Now, I was in a what's known as a Morrison shelter, which is the tabletop shelter, in our sitting room with my mother. My father was looking out of the back window and realised that something was going to happen, and fortunately dived for the shelter and just about got under. I gather he got slightly trapped. The lady next door was in another shelter, and she was okay. The miracle was the man, Mr. Cooper, who was looking out of his bathroom window when the bomb hit the corner of his kitchen just below him. But the blast was such that his house basically came up and fell down on us, and he fell through the superstructure and was only superficially hurt. But the building was reduced to a complete heap of rubble. And my mother said that the blast, if there was any grass or any green stuff, it was as if a giant hand had swept it all off the ground. And if there was any posts, it was just a mush. And the blast actually affected properties in the High Street, which is 3/4 of a mile away. We were the only house that was completely demolished. There were three houses opposite, and it lifted the roof up on one and put the curtains from the upstairs windows and trapped them as it fell back again. And we, a neighbour across the road actually was first on the site in the dark to see if he could find anybody alive, basically, and he found a hole and realised that we were trapped under this, in this shelter. And a small hole was made, and apparently I was the first person, first body to be handed out, if you like. But when the dawn came, they wondered if they'd really ought to have done that, because hanging just above where we came out was a fireplace from the upstairs, which was just hanging on by wires. So we were really, truly blessed. Now, there was a ARP warden's bungalow at the top of Acacia Drive, and my mother and father and myself, I suppose, walked up the road to this place, and my mother said it was the only time she had walked up the road in her nightdress. And we were absolutely, everybody's hair and everything was absolutely full of dust because the blast caused it to go absolutely everywhere.
You were only young, you didn't remember, you don't remember.
I don't remember anything about it, no. Mm. We then were moved into temporary accommodation, It took 4 years before the government allowed us to rebuild the house. They rebuilt it under war damage. And we moved back in 1948. And then, as I say, the Acacia Drive was then a muddy strip from the top down to almost where we live, then Mr. Binder's strip, and then in the early 50s, the co-op, local cooperative society, owned the rest of the land right down to Washington Road. And that's when the rest of Acacia Drive was put in. And then the council came along and made up the top bit under the private streetworks code. But that cost the residents at the top bit, because they had to pay for the cost of doing it. So it cost an absolute fortune. And one chap had to sell most of his garden to pay for the cost of putting this road in. But until it was an absolute nightmare during the winter to get from what was a proper road outside our house to a spittle road, because it was just one muddy track. And it really was awful. You didn't go up in best shoes.
So Acacia Drive's got a really interesting history, hasn't it?
It has, actually, yes. And also, off Acacia Drive, of course, halfway down, you've got Granger Avenue. Now, that is so named because there used to be a family called the Grangers in Malden, and they all that land, whether it is now, was their orchard. And that was developed in the late 50s, I think. And so it went on. Yes.
Yeah, fascinating. There wasn't much war damage in Malden, was there?
Well, there was a certain amount. There was some houses in Fambridge Road, about opposite where Granger Avenue comes out, with big curved windows. They were suffered a bomb hit. And one of the worst things was about six houses were totally destroyed in Washington Road with a direct hit with a V2 rocket, and it killed quite a number of people. But the big problem with the war was that Malden, of course, was on the trajectory for London, and if bombers came over to bomb London and were turned back, they never went back with a full bomb load, so we suffered with bombs being dropped as they went back.
Yeah,
that was right. That was the main problem.
Yeah. Mm. Well, you had a traumatic early start to your life.
Yes,
didn't you?
Yes. And then I was in 1947, we were still living in the temporary accommodation, I started school at All Saints Church of England School in London Road. That's now finally been turned into some flats, I think. But anyway, it was a school for many, many years. And I started in the reception class in 1947. Very nice teacher. And then moved up to Miss Metcalfe's class, Nellie Metcalfe, who was a very good teacher. And my abiding memory of that was we were sitting in these old-fashioned desks in rows, and every morning we would chant the times tables. And, of course, once you've learnt your times tables, you never forget them, which children don't do nowadays.
Not much. No.
Not much. And then, anyway, the next class up was Mrs. Anderson, and she was a very good teacher. But the school at that time, the headmaster was a Mr. Marchant and his wife, and they were true Victorians. They really were not very nice people. And I moved into her form. She was the one just below the 11-plus year. And I don't quite remember. She didn't stop that long. They retired, fortunately. But when I moved into her class, she had a singing lesson, and I was asked to sing the scale, Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti, Do. Well, I didn't know what she was talking about, so I couldn't do it. You can't sing. Sit over there. And there was a row of us that every time you had a singing lesson, this is what went on in those days, you had to sit out. Anyway, fortunately, as I say, she retired and Mr. Jelly became the headmaster, and he was the choir master at All Saints, and he was very active in the town for many, many years. And of course, you saw this lot sitting out. What are you not doing sitting out? Well, sir, we can't sing. Nonsense, says Mr. Jelly. About 2 years later, I sang a solo in the Congregational Church where I went, and I've sung ever since. So that was my experience of All Saints, quite frankly. I fortunately managed to get through the 11 plus and went on to the grammar school, but that apart.
Looking back, though, was it a happy time or not?
Oh, it wasn't too bad. It wasn't too bad. I mean, we had friends and, you know, we were there. But it was a very, very primitive school. The toilets and things were all outside. There was no indoor facilities for a long time. It really was, you know, pretty awful. But no. We survived quite happily.
And then you said you went on to the grammar school.
I went on to the grammar school and obviously progressed.
And after the grammar school?
After the grammar school, I hadn't actually got a place at university. And I was given a job application by the headmaster because he thought it might suit me at Chelmsford Borough Council. A legal career in local government. You had to do an external London law degree whilst working, and then there was going to be free articles to the town clerk. So I applied and had an interview and got the job. And I started as a junior committee clerk shortly after my 18th birthday. And it actually took me 6 years to become a solicitor, to get my law degree, because I did it correspondence course to start with, but latterly went to the Mid-Essex Tech in the evenings and things, and that was very good. And I again did articles and became a solicitor, and remained a solicitor, moved to Colchester, and I wound up as head of legal services for Colchester Borough Council.
Did you?
Yeah, and then took early retirement at 50, and I've been retired for 76 years. 26 years, I mean.
Good for you.
So that was good. Yeah. But another thing that we had quite a lot of experience of in Maldon, and both my parents worked for the local Maldon and Heybridge Cooperative Society. They both worked in the office. And, of course, in the 1940s and 1950s, the co-op actually owned more property in the town than anybody. They had shops all up and down the high street, which sold absolutely everything. They delivered stuff all round the Dengie Hundred, right down to Burnham, Southminster, Tillingham. We had coal rounds, we had bread rounds, and we had milk rounds, and obviously all the shops. And I remember going out with my father paying the divvy, because anybody who was a member of the co-op had a number, and every time you bought anything in those days, the person wrote a little chit out, which was called a cheque, with your number and the amount you'd spent. And these were all calculated in the office. And at the end of the year, if the co-op had made a profit, which it did in those days, so much in the pound was given back to all these members in a proportion to how much they'd actually spent.
Where was the office? Where was the co-op office?
The co-op office in for most of the time was above Essex Beds at the top of the Market Hill, because Essex Beds and the property next door, one was a men's outfitters, the other side was ladies' wear, and then you went up a stairs in the middle and the offices were above.
Right.
The current town hall was what's known as the Jubilee Hall of the co-op, and that was the Jubilee of the co-op, not Jubilee of the Queen. It was the Jubilee of the Maldon and Heybridge Cooperative Society.
Yeah.
Part of the office was also a boot and shoe shop. Where the funeral director's car park is now, that was a general grocery store, where I can remember you had counters down either side, ladies standing behind the counters. You went and ordered what you wanted, and they went and got it from the stock. Sugar was produced in blue bags. Cheese was cut accordingly.
And that was owned by the co-op?
That was all the co-op, and there was a... Oh, yes, yes.
What was a Jubilee Hall used for?
We had a chap that did weddings and all sorts of things. We had receptions and things here. Mm. Oh, yes. Mm. And where Coe's is, that was the furniture shop and radio shop and paint shop. They had one of the first supermarkets in the town after the ordinary grocery shop closed. They sold Green Grocery, where Wenlock's is now. That was the Green Grocery shop.
Do you know what caused the decline of the co-op?
Bad management, quite frankly.
Right.
And a changing of times, but yeah. They had a manager who spent rather more than he should have done and tried to develop more than he should, and things went wrong. But I remember we had a huge bakery roughly behind Costa Coffee, and one Easter when I hadn't quite left school, I went bagging up hot cross buns. Started at 3 a.m. and worked round to about 11, because the roundsman used to take them out, 5 buns in a bag for a shilling, which is now 5p. And they used to bake, on the Thursday and Friday, 50,000 hot cross buns. And the smell was exquisite, the spice and everything else. And you certainly could go in old pair of shoes, because the time you'd finish, you had a thick sole of currants on your feet.
And were you allowed to eat some?
One or two, but you really didn't really need to. But it was quite an interesting thing.
So I'm backtracking a little. So the co-op owned a lot of the land down here.
Where Plume Avenue is and Essex Road, that was a blackcurrant field which they owned.
Really?
They owned all of the Poets' Estate, which was small holdings.
Huge
amount of land. And they, as I say, it was all sold off and developed, but as I say, things went wrong.
And because potentially it was a very, very wealthy company.
So, as I say, I can remember milk floats coming around with the milkman, and bread vans and
absolutely
coal lorries.
Michael, how long have you been attending the church, what was the Congregational Church and now the United Reformed Church?
I have basically been attending or going to it all my life, in that my grandfather was church secretary in the 1930s, and he died in 1940, and then my father became the head of the Sunday school, and then I became a full member and indeed the treasurer of the church in the early 1990s, although I attended but didn't actually join the church straight away. Now, the church itself has a very interesting history, in that I don't know how many people have heard the expression "go like Billy-O," but it actually originates from the Malden United Reformed Church, in that the church is situated at the top of the Market Hill. It's the big building that sits back from the road. And in 1688, the Reverend Joseph Billy-O came from Witham, and he was an independent minister from the Church of England, so he was allowed to go his own way, if you like. And by 1692, largely at his own expense, he built a chapel to house 400 people, which, if you think about it, in those days was a considerable number of people. And it is said that he preached with such verve and gusto, they had to open the windows so more people could come and listen to him outside. And you go like, or do things like, Billy-O. And if anybody likes to come to the church, there is a oil painting of the old boy in our vestry. I'm not at all sure I should want to listen to him, because I have a horrible feeling that his sermons probably went on for about 2 hours, which would be far too long for me. But anyway, his building lasted roughly 100 years when a group of independent trustees decided to put up a new building. And the original John Sad, of John Sad and Sons, the timber merchants, was the carpenter who built the church. And the main building there now today is a timber-framed lath and plaster building. And it's been altered, obviously. A front was put on with the portico and pillars, etc. And the back was altered a bit. And in the year 2000, we totally altered it, because up to that point it had pews on the ground floor. And we stripped it all out. And it now, if people go in there, we've now got chairs, underfloor heating, and it's slightly foreshortened both ways. We have a welcoming area as you come in, and the dais is slightly altered as well. So, but when we were, well, I was there actually when the workmen were pulling the place to bits in the year 2000, out of the wall fell a glass bottle, a time capsule. And we were advised, fortunately, I was there at the time, and I collared this, and we took advice from the Essex Records Office, because you could see certain things inside, and we were told not to open it. And we, fortunately, Olive Earnshaw, it used to be one of our elders, worked in the Plume Library, and she managed to find details of what was in the bottle. So we got a record of that. And as we were doing this new work to the church, we created another time capsule as to what we'd done in the year 2000. And both are buried back somewhere in the wall. I won't say where, I know roughly where, but so in the church there are two time capsules.
Both time capsules,
mm-hmm. Yes. And, of course, the church is now used extensively for concerts and all sorts of things. We have a superb piano and everything else. Mm. And I've been its treasurer for about 26 years, so I have quite a lot to do with it.
Mm. It's certainly a beautiful church.
Yes.
On the side of quite a sloping piece of land.
Yes, and that is causing us severe problems at the moment. Back of the church is actually moving. Yes. It moves with the weather. If it gets dry, it moves one way, and if it gets wet, it moves another. Mm. But it is. If it had been a solid building, it probably wouldn't be there. The fact that it is timber framed allows it a certain amount of movement without being too heavy.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Thank you very much, Michael.
Right.